I do have a 2-year-old, but I'm not sure I can blame everything on him.
But it's hard not to.
It's hard not to. All right. So let's open with some prayer. Lord, thanks for today and your Bible that you've given us. Pray you'd speak to us this morning and show us something new and something that we need to know that would encourage us to dig deeper. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen.
So, it's Esther time. It's Purim tonight. Everyone knows that? I decided to get down my Nigerian outfit.
Good for you.
And give it a wear. Thankfully, there's no Yoruba present with us because the Yoruba would be disappointed that my hairpiece is not big enough instead of a big bowl like that. So apologies to all the Yoruba out there, but make do.
Is this what you did on Thursday? Or somewhat?
What do you mean, is this?
Is this studying about the Thursday?
Well, I figured since we have some people who were not there, we could do some, but also traditionally you read through Esther for Purim. And on Thursday I did a talk about the irony in the book of Esther and how that helps us understand the book. And in fact, the author is intending us to enjoy it and to laugh. That's not a sin. That's important part of the book. But I thought today we could actually read some sections of the book as well, because the other night I was just quoting verses here and there and you don't get the feel of it. So we won't have enough time to read through the whole book. I'm thinking we'll at least read up to where Esther goes to the king. And then we'll also maybe touch on the additions to Esther, which, for any of you, anyone here read the additions to Esther? I see. They're found in what's now known as the Apocrypha, and they were written Second Temple times. I think the earliest example, the additions to Esther, were like 111 BC. The additions were all written in Greek, and they're, to me, they're clearly later, although maybe some could argue that they're preserving some.
We support people learning Greek here.
Sure, yes. Greek, Hebrew.
Sure, yo-yo.
So, who would like to read, let's break it up, chapter 1, maybe 1 to 10, or 1 to 9, and maybe everybody take a chunk. Could I have you start, and
sure.
We'll just go that way?
Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods, and marble pillars and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavish according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion. For the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus.
Okay, I'll just make a few background comments here. First of all, you see this, it sounds tremendous, almost exaggerated his banquet, 180 days. You know, this is a huge deal. The author goes into detail setting up the grandeur and the glory of this big king. The other night, I pointed out how that is setting you up to see the irony of it when it all gets turned on its head. Because at the end of the book, Mordecai is dressed in all the same grandeur and uses the same words as given here. The cloth, the fine white cloth, he read, the purple, silver, he's got the gold ring of the king. And so there's like this reversal where instead of, you know, the Persian king being this grand monarch, you have Mordecai emerging, wearing the splendor of the Persian stuff on him. But also historically, you see little hints. The Persians were known for their wine fests. They had many of them. And the word mishte there, that we translate feast, we're assuming that there was food served as well, but it is first and foremost a wine fest. And then, and we know the Persians also valued this. They had a lot of drinking vessels that were gold and silver, and it was their way of showing off with each other who had the best drinking vessels. And you can see some, I'm sure most of your esteemed museums today should have a couple examples. So this part, you know, there's little historical truths in there, characteristics. But that's all the backdrop to our story of this, you know, great splendor. And it's really so that we can see how that splendor is nothing compared to ultimately who's working behind the scenes. So let's keep reading. Verse 10.
On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded, oh, here we go, Mahuman, Bistha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Habakha, Zithar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Maris, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she had not performed the command of King Ahasuerus, delivered by the eunuchs? What is okay. to be done?
Maybe we'll stop there a second.
Okay.
Thanks for reading all those names. I pointed out the other night some of the ironies in here. But first, to put yourself in the cultural context, in Persia at the time, women had their separate feast, men had their separate feast. When men were in their feast drinking, the only women that would go in there were courtesans, there to entertain, you know.
What language is courtesan?
That's a good question. Latin?
And it means?
Exotic dancers, flute players. These people were also the ones, you know, they might know some poetry, they might be skilled dancers, they might play flutes, and they certainly were pretty and decorated and there to entertain.
They so, are also called putain.
All right. So, so when Vashti says no, that's the obvious answer. Anyone with self-respect would say no. However, the king, as we shall see, he's very just childish and controlled by his own little desires. Like, she crossed my will, and I'm just going to be mad about it. But you'll notice he also doesn't, he turns this into a big, huge deal. Instead of just saying, you know, this is a disagreement between my wife and I'm going to turn to the leaders of the state and ask, you know, what should be done? And if you read the tone of the book, I think it's very, on these matters, it's very tongue-in-cheek when it talks about Persian law. You know, the laws of the Persians can't be broken. And then the whole book is about how they're turned on their head. You know, so it's, there's a lot of ironies going on there. And of course, you know, this king, what has to be done? And he's turning to other people, and so he's about to get Memuchan's, one of his advisors, advice. Clearly, as a king is the one that's supposed to be responsible, you know, for justice and laws, and he obviously relies on other people. He's not much of a example of a king for us. Okay, so verse 16.
Then Memuchan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the people of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who will have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord.
Okay. I don't hear any laughter out there. You know this story too well. But this is hilarious. I mean, Memuchan is now saying, you know, all the people everywhere and all the wives in all the kingdom, this very day, you know, there's going to be no end to contempt, and it's clearly exaggerated and very funny. I mean, he's turning it into a whole every husband and every wife, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very funny. So you can keep reading a couple more verses there. Verse 19.
Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes, and also let the king give her royal position to someone else who's better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all the vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands, from the least to the greatest. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice. So they were drunk. So the king did as Memuchan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household.
Which, this is pretty funny too, because in the whole book, you know, the whole point of all of this is, you know, we're going to show how great we are, and all the wives are going to give glory to the husbands, you know, and then the rest of the story, we're going to find out it's exactly the opposite. You know, Esther is the one initiating this plan of salvation. Zeresh, Haman's wife, is the one telling him what to do. And so there's this kind of cute play where even though they're stating, what they're stating literally is the opposite of what actually happens. Mm-hmm. Including, you know, the laws of the Medes and Persians can't be broken. You see how, in essence, they are. They're reversed by other laws. Okay, let's keep reading chapter 2.
After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her.
Let me just make my little comment there I made the other night. Notice the king says what was decreed against her, right? As opposed to what I decreed against her. He's already thinking, in his viewpoint, he's the victim of his own law. You know, he's already forgotten that he was the one who did it. You know, so it's another point of irony that kind of makes us see him as childish and not really knowing what's going on. Okay, keep reading.
Then the king's attendants who served him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to Susa, the capital, to the harem into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. Then the young lady who pleases the king Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite.
All right, pause there. What does that tell us? Who is Mordecai's ancestor, great-great-granddad?
Saul.
Saul, king of Israel. Okay, read the next verse.
Who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. And he was bringing up Hadassah, that's Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. Now, the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it came about, when the command and decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered to Susa, the capital, into the custody of Haggai, that Esther was taken into the king's palace, into the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him, so he quickly provided her with cosmetics and food, and gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known.
All right. This is interesting to our book also. Esther's pretty subversive in many ways. She's our heroine of the book, and she's not what you would expect, especially in Second Temple times. Who else do we know of who is a woman hero, a heroine in Second Temple times? Like from the Apocrypha. Do you remember other stories?
Judith.
Deborah. Susanna. Let's take Judith. She's a big one. She, Holofernes, the foreign enemy, has surrounded her city, and they're going to have to surrender. And this means, you know, destruction of the Jewish people. And so she's going to go out and save her people. But the author very clearly tells us, you know, her husband has died, so she's never remarried. She does all the ritual baths. She brings kosher food with her because she knows when she goes out to the enemy camp, it's not going to be kosher food. And, the author is very clear about telling us all the little details of, you know, why she is clean and fit for this job. And here we have Esther, and she's, you know, hiding her identity, which means if she's not saying anything, they're going to be serving her what they serve everyone else. Mm-hmm. You know, so she's kind of, it's wildly unexpected. And yet, as we see, you know, essential for the plot. So, do you have English there? No. So maybe, David, you could read from verse 11.
Every day Mordecai took a walk in front of the harem's courtyard to learn how Esther was doing and to see what was happening to her. During the year, before each young woman's turn to go to King Cyrus, the harem regularly required her to receive beauty treatments with oil and myrrh for 6 months, and then with perfumes and cosmetics for another 6 months. When the young woman would go to the king, she was given whatever she requested to take with her from the harem to the palace. She would go in the evening, and in the morning she would return to the second harem under the supervision of Shashagas, the king's eunuch in charge of the concubines. She never went to the king again unless he desired her and summoned her by name. Esther was the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as his own daughter. When her turn came to go to the king, she did not ask for anything except what Haggai, the king's trusted official in charge of the harem, suggested.
Wait, hold on a second. Verse 14. Does your verse include that too, that Esther was the daughter of...
That's in 15.
Oh, okay, so it just changed the order. All right, that's good. Okay, so finish verse 15, did you do that?
Yeah, the king trusted official in charge of the harem suggested. Esther won approval in sight of everyone who saw her. And then Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus in the royal palace in the 10th month, the month of Tebet, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won more favor and approval from him than did any of the other virgins. He placed the royal crown on her head and made her queen in the place of Vashti.
All right. I'm glad this king was good with names. I know if I had so many people coming through, I don't know if I'd remember which one I liked by name. But notice Esther so far in the whole book, you know, just this grace and this liking. Everybody who sees her likes her. She's just kind of like this naturally wonderful person. Or supernatural. Yeah, it reminds us of Joseph and Daniel. They just, even though they start at the bottom, they just keep rising because of who they are.
The king has all these women. In other words, all the selected virgins for one night. Mm-hmm. And then he decides if he wants somebody back or he picks his queen from that group.
Right.
But now they're all his concubines or anyway.
Well, whatever. They go to the concubine house. Yeah, they would become some kind of concubine, but not the queen. And whether he remembers them enough to ever see them again, they may just live in his palace for the rest of their life and be pretty decoration. Which would kind of be unfortunate if you weren't chosen.
It'd be very popular amongst the young adults, you know, the adult males in the country. All the pretty women are taken away.
Yeah, that's right. And at what point did Esther actually get her turn? Like, how many were before her? And from the king's perspective, you know, each. What if the first one was amazing, but you're like, well, I wonder who else is out there.
Yeah.
You can never go back, you know. Once you've gone forward, it's kind of a risk. So Esther must have been really amazing to be like, okay, that's the one. So in all these little series of coincidences, we see that there's a bigger hand behind it all. So he puts the royal keter, the royal crown or turban or whatever, on her head and makes her queen. And we get another feast. Go ahead and read for us.
Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. Now when the virgins gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred and her people as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was reported in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king.
Okay, let's stop there a second. Great, so the plot thickens here. We have an assassination plot on the king that's foiled by Mordecai. And through Esther, he's able to get this communication to the king. So, the very next verse we have, and after these things, what does the king do? He makes Haman great. Very interesting. What were we all expecting to hear? Mordecai. Mordecai just saved the king's life, right? And boom, the exact opposite. Where's this Haman guy coming from? Maybe Carla, you can read the first verse there, chapter 3.
After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Amminadab, the Agite, and advanced him, and set his feet above all the princes that were with him.
All right. That's kind of language we're used to hearing about a king, to set his throne above everyone else. Agag. Who is Agag? The guy that Samuel chopped up. Why did Samuel chop him up?
Because Saul was supposed to have killed him, but he brought him back as a prisoner.
Yeah, we're going exactly backwards. Yeah, if you look at 1 Samuel 15... Saul is rejected from being king of Israel over this issue. What is the issue? He was told to wipe out the Amalekites. Agag is king of the Amalekites. He does go out and raid against them, but what does he do, according to chapter 15? He kills the Amalekites, but he takes Agag, the king, alive, and he lets the people plunder. Why is this bad? Go back more. Well, actually, apparently here in 1 Samuel 15, it's told us that they're not supposed to plunder anything. It's supposed to be completely wiped out. But there's a reflection of the law in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 17 through 19. Also an important thing to be reading around fully. And it says, Deuteronomy 25, 17 through 19. Be remembering what Amalek did to you on the way as you were leaving Egypt, that he chanced upon you, or he jumped on you on the way, and he tailed you. Presumably he cut off your tail. All the stragglers behind you, and that's a very strange word there, Neheshalim. And you were tired and weary, or you could even translate thirsty and weary, and didn't fear God. There's a huge question, who's not fearing God here? Is it the Israelites or the Amalekites? It's weird because of the syntax. But then verse 19, and it will be when you get rest, when the Lord God gives you rest from all your enemies around you, in the land that the Lord your God will give you as an inheritance to inherit, you will surely wipe out the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. Don't forget. So you're supposed to completely wipe it out. And of course, this law is going back to Exodus 17, 8-16, where we actually get the story of how Amalek attacked. And in that story, we don't know that they attacked the rear. This is Deuteronomy's explaining for us why, part of why it was so bad that they attacked. But there we do get the same command, or this actually it's not a command there, the same statement from the Lord, I will surely wipe them out from under the heavens. And what says the memory of Amalek? Obviously it doesn't mean the memory, because we recite this every year. Remember, don't forget. It kind of sounds ironic there as well. However, the memory is referring to progeny, right? Your kids, that's how you're remembered by. That's how your life is extended. And so, so it would be wiping out Amalek and his descendants. And if you remember from when God revealed himself to Moses in the burning bush, he says, I'm the Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is my name and this is my remembrance from generation to generation. So God's memory is parallel to God's name. And his identity is tied up with a particular little family, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so you kind of have the pitting of these two nations against each other. God's chosen, that he's associated his name with that people. So all their descendants are somehow God's descendants, in a way. And that's pitted against the Amalekites, and their descendants will be wiped out. So, that's all introducing Haman for us, and why he is evil before we even know why he's evil. Okay, so verse 2, who's reading first? Emma, you can read.
And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman. But the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, and nor did he do him a reverence. Then the king's servants which were in the king's gate said unto Mordecai, why transgresses thou the king's commandment? Now it came to pass when they spoke daily, unto him, and he hearkened not unto him, that they told Haman, to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone. For they had showed him the people of Mordecai, wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. In the first month, that is, the month of Nisan, and the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, the lot, before Haman from day to day, from month to month, to the 12th month, that is, the month of Adar. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of the kingdom. And the laws are diverse from all people, neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore, it is not for the king's profit to suffer them.
Okay. So we'll stop here. Here we have the name of our holiday, Purim, is the lots. And obviously, the Persians here are believing in the lots. In ancient Near East, there were many gods, of course, and there were certain things that the gods would fight over. They fought over fate. They fought over the laws of truth. They fought over the natural laws. Who was in control of these things? So you never know which god would be in control at what time. It's more of a, I guess, I don't know, a democracy, but not a democracy because they're fighting over it. But this is in contrast to the biblical view where, sure, you might have laws of nature and fate. I mean, things happen in sequence, but God's above all of that. And so God's going to use their very lots. The day that they choose, God's going to turn it around. So he waits for them to actually do it according to their idea.
Choose a day for what?
For destroying the Jews.
Okay, so the plan.
So we remember that God is never mentioned in this book at all. No God, no prayer, nothing. So we have to follow all the hints of when you expect the very thing you expect gets flipped on the head, you know, by chance. Everything seems to be by coincidence. But because there's so many coincidences that line up, that's your clue that it's not coincidence at all. And so you have to kind of read between the lines. And you're expected to read between the lines. Just like we were expected to read between the lines about Saul and Amalek. That's part of us understanding. The other funny thing is, you know, Mordecai and Haman, this is personal rivalry. And again, like the king did, he's making it into a nationalistic, huge thing. You know, I don't want to get rid of Mordecai. All his people, everywhere. You know, it's very, very exaggerated response. Now, why wouldn't Mordecai bow down to Haman?
Because he is an Amalekite?
Yeah, I don't know. We're not really given a reason here.
What have you heard people say?
How have people explained this before?
The Jews wouldn't bow down to be obedient to other gods or in foreign land.
Right. People connect it to idolatry. That's what the additions to Esther connect it to. They kind of make the mental parallel to the book of Daniel. But the words here are essentially crouch down and prostrate before. Abraham bowed down to the three angels that came. People bow down all the time to other people. It doesn't necessarily mean you're worshiping them. It's a custom. Prostration is part of the
respect.
Way that you respect each other in greeting. Obviously, it would be showing a ranking. But it's interesting how...
Well, it's more than just a greeting.
Yeah, no, it's a respect.
It's a subservient greeting.
Right, subservient greeting,
it's
for
a
sure.
A pecking order.
A pecking order, yeah.
Strongly.
Strongly. The point is, it's not necessarily idolatrous to bow down to someone.
But today, it would just be like if someone stuck out their hand to shake it, and you didn't shake their hand, it would be a disrespect. Right?
Sure. I mean, today we're a much more informal culture in the West, but maybe in the Far East, they'd have more rituals, like if you shake your hand without touching both hands, or you know, if you give someone something with one hand instead of two, that's very disrespectful. It's one of those kind of things where you show your subservience to the person above you by acting a certain way.
We have it still in England, even the Queen's grandchildren.
Right, there's a certain protocol. There you go. But in the end, this is this is a lack of living up to kind of the protocol. This isn't actually anything to do with idolatry. Now, it could be Mordecai's choice not to follow protocol was because he knew of Haman's character and didn't respect it. I don't know. Okay. Let's keep reading. The next person, go ahead.
Okay. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business. So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, his son of Hammath, the Adam, the enemy of the Jews. Keep the money, the king said to Haman, and rule the people as you please.
Okay, pause there. At the end of the verse, end of the book, we won't get to today, the king does the exact same thing for Esther and Mordecai. You know, here's my ring, write anything you want. So he's clearly not very interested in the content of this law. Again, it makes the king look pretty pathetic, pretty ridiculous. Also, you notice Haman is deliberately vague about this people group. He doesn't say it's the Jews, you know. There's a certain people out there. He's trying to convince
them. And they do not obey the king's laws. And what? No mention of what they're not doing.
Exactly. Their biggest offense is that they keep their own laws, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they're not integrating enough, basically. But it's interesting that later when Haman comes to the king in the middle of the night, when the king can't sleep, and says, what can I do to make this particular person great? And the king is deliberately vague with Haman there. And so it's kind of like, it serves him right. You know, the way he acted with the king is the way the king acts with him later. There's nice little subtle things like that.
Do you think he could see through Haman's plots or something at that point? Or do you think he was still kind of vague?
I think the way the king is depicted in this book, he can't see through anything. He's pretty dull.
Yeah.
The problem is he just doesn't care to see through it. He just cares about his personal, you know, wine, women, and
sleep.
When his personal little world is invaded, then he cares. You know, I can't sleep. Now bring me the records and let me read them. What? More wine. So he's obviously depicted as very childish in that regard. And the fact that he gives his ring to somebody to write a law, and he doesn't even care what they write. And Haman writes one law, and Esther writes the exact opposite, and he doesn't seem to even notice. That also makes us laugh. It's also ridiculous. So they bring out all the scribes on a certain day, and they write according to what Haman says. They send it out to every place in their own language and in their own writing, and it's sealed with the king's ring. Now, this historically, verse 13 I'm looking at. Historically, this is true that the Persians had a very good postal service, so to speak, relay runners that went out and could distribute commands, and of course, a lot of translators to get it out from basically where Sudan is today, all the way to India.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a nice bit of historical characteristic in there. Okay, what does the command say, verse 13? Nick, you can read.
Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces, giving orders to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation, calling on all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went quickly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion.
Notice the king sits down to drink, you know, totally oblivious that he's just decreed to destroy a large community in his kingdom.
But then the benefit is that he never has responsibility. So he can not even remember when Esther asked, you know, when Esther makes her plea, who did this and what's this right. about? I don't even remember. And Queen Vashti, now, let's see, why isn't she here today? Well, oh, yeah,
right.
I remember.
Oh, yeah. it's a hangover. the problem is, by nature, he's supposed to have responsibility as a king. It's his signet ring. So in the end, he's responsible whether he knows it or not, you know. Okay, so notice they were supposed to kill everybody in the Jews on one day and plunder. We remember back in 1 Samuel 15, the people were specifically commanded, don't plunder your enemies. And so when you read the book, and we know it gets reversed, chapter 9, 1, the very day they were supposed to be plundered, or they were supposed to be killed, they could defend themselves and gain the upper hand. But it makes special mention that they did not plunder. Twice in Esther it tells you that. And that's on purpose, to tell you that this time they're obeying God and they're not plundering. Whereas in 1 Samuel 15, they disobeyed. And they plundered. And basically the whole book of Esther is trying to make up for what didn't happen in 1 Samuel 15. So where Saul messed up, Mordecai does it right. And Esther does it right. Mordecai makes a nice foil with Saul because he's a guy. But really, the hero or heroine is split between Esther and Mordecai in this story. let us skip down a little bit to verse. Actually, no, we'll need to read a little bit. So Mordecai is fasting in the gate. He's deeply distressed. And, we'll need to read it. Nick, go ahead and read chapter 4, verse 1.
When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went through the city, wailing with a loud and bitter cry.
Just keep going. Yeah.
He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. In every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and most of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them.
Okay, pause there. What's deeply distressing Esther? I mean, it's kind of funny. She's deeply distressed, and what does she do? She sends him clothes so he can get out of his sackcloth. It's like, what, the fact that he's not dressed well is deeply distressing you? Don't you get it? You know? It's kind of, she's also kind of oblivious in that sense.
Boy daughters aren't, though? Their dads don't dress right?
I don't know. It never bothered me. Maybe just because my dad's always dressed right. I don't know. But I think there's a lot of irony here, and you can see Esther's character. She's, you know, she's very assimilated. She's been very obedient up till now, but she hasn't really thought much about the consequences of the big picture. And in this chapter, she has her, like, kind of aha moment. Okay, so he doesn't accept the clothes, and so then she kind of has to figure out, okay, what's bothering him? Why won't he accept the clothes? And she's got this back and forth dialogue, sending her servant to Mordecai and back again.
You don't think she heard the edict herself, and she wasn't too, just as long as I'm quiet, no one, it shouldn't affect me?
I mean, there could be a mixture of all of that. Either she, I'm sure she knew the edict. She's figuring she's safe.
And she is isolated, though.
She is. And nobody knows she's a Jew.
Yeah.
So in many ways, she is safe. Okay. Okay, so what does Mordecai tell her?
Verse 8 kind of gives you the idea that she has not seen the decree, because he sends a written copy to her.
Well, yeah, I think you could interpret it both ways. Either that she didn't know at all, or that he's like, hello, wake up, haven't you read this? And it could be that she just wasn't even thinking about it. It wasn't relevant to her, and so she didn't care. It's like you can live and not know the news at all if you're just wrapped into your own little world, if it doesn't affect you. I mean, if you're living in Japan, yeah, you're going to know what's going on. If you're living in Iceland, you don't have to if you don't want to. You know, so it's kind of one of those things. You have that personal choice. Okay, so verse 13 is our nice big verse. Let's see, back there, Teresa, you could read for us.
13?
Yeah.
And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?
I'll pause right there. That's really kind of like a climactic point of the verse. And notice, where's help going to come from?
Another place.
This would have been the perfect place to put in God if you wanted to. And actually, future Jewish interpretation, the place refers to God. It's one of the ways you can call God to revere it instead of using his name. But here it's on purpose. And I said the other night in a talk I gave that I think it's reflecting a particular understanding of Exodus 17, 8 through 16, where the last verse says there's a hand on the throne of God. But if you redivided the words, our Greek translation shows an interpretation by a hidden hand. God has war with Amalek. And so this author, if he is going with that interpretation, is trying to show how God is having a hidden battle against Amalek. So that would explain why there's all these... We just see the human plane. We don't get to see the supernatural element. But because of all these series of coincidences, we know by the product, we know that, you know, there's a hidden hand waging war. And so here, the author, if he's consistent and faithful to his style, he can't put God in the picture at all, because he's just trying to show the one human plane. So he's like, help will come from another place. And, you know, let the reader understand what place that is. Okay, so Esther finally gets it, and she says, okay, you know, sends everyone off fasting, and she's going to fast. But again, we have no mention of prayer in the book. In our minds, when we hear fasting, we obviously associate it with prayer, so we can kind of fill in the gaps. And it's interesting, when you read Esther, some personalities are bothered that it's not more explicit. And so that's how we got the additions to Esther. And in the additions, we have nice, beautiful, lengthy prayers that she prayed. And it reflects some of the theology of the time. You know, we've sinned, that's why we were sent into exile in the first place. You know, and now, you know, remember, O Lord, make yourself known in our affliction. Give me boldness, O King of the nations and Lord of all power. Give me eloquent speech in my mouth before the lion, referring to the king. Turn his heart to hate him that fighteth against us, and may there be an end to him and all of them that are like-minded. But deliver us with your hand, and help me, that who is desolate, and which has no other helper but you. And so it kind of makes... It shows us the inside of Esther's mind, whether she had a prayer exactly like this or not. It wants us to realize, the author of the editions wants us to realize, that Esther could do nothing by herself anyway. It wasn't her fancy clothes, her good looks. It was all God. So, and yet both things were true. And I think the great thing about the book of Esther for me is it's the book that's most like our life. When you're just living your life, we see the human plane. Unless, has anyone here ever seen an angel? Every night we pray with our two-year-old, and I just always pray, you know, and Lord, put your angels around his bed, and, you know, protect him, and, you know, help him grow well, help him know you, stuff like that. And one night, Sara says, where are the angels? Like, I don't see them. You know, it's like, yeah, you're right. You can't always see angels. And children's questions, you know, just put things the way it is. I've never seen an angel. You know, I know there's a spiritual thing out there, but like the wind, you see the leaves blow, but you can't see the wind. You know, you can't see the spiritual dimension a lot of times. And so it's open to interpretation. You know, when something happens to you, am I late because, you know, I was supposed to miss this or that? Or is it just random? And you don't often see the hand of God. And yet a book like Esther, you know, when you look at the big picture, you start to see how things line up and how God is coordinating things even though you can't see him. So to me, Esther is actually a very encouraging book because you can relate to it. It's the world you're used to looking at. Whereas the rest of the Bible makes it look like it was all easy for them because, oh, God told them that. Duh. I think, actually, though, it's really just a difference of style, where in the other parts of the Bible, it was not necessarily any more obvious than it is to us. There are cases where it was. But when God told something to the prophets, we don't know how he said it. It could have been the same way he speaks to us, where it's a thought we have in our mind that we just know was not our own. You know? So, a difference of style, and it really, it's encouraging to know that the big picture, that there is this hand that's directing things. Hand, of course, being the metaphor for God's power to help things happen. And that God has a sense of humor, you know? He's using these foreign people, and it's like they're little puppets. And even though they're making decisions, he's able to, you know, make sure he doesn't have good sleep just the night that he needs to not have good sleep so that he can save Mordecai's life and such things like that. So we're out of time for this morning. Make sure for those who haven't read Esther to read through the whole thing. That's a wonderful book. And I guess we didn't get to the part about Esther. Let me just read just to close, because it's kind of fun. It fills in a lot of the gaps if you read the additions to Esther. When she goes before the king, I'll just read you this little section. I'm in chapter 15 of the Apocrypha, addition to Esther, verse 6. Then having passed through all the doors, she stood before the king, who sat upon his royal throne and was clothed with all his robes of majesty, all glittering with gold and precious stones, and he was very dreadful. Then lifting up his countenance that shone with majesty, he looked very fiercely upon her, and the queen fell down and was pale and fainted. It's all very Victorian kind of. And bowed herself upon the head of the maid that went before her. Then God changed the spirit of the king into mildness. Okay, so this is explaining how it doesn't have to do with Esther, it's God. Who in fear leaped from his throne and took her in his arms till she came to herself again and comforted her with loving words and said unto her, Esther, what is the matter? I am thy brother, be of good cheer. Thou shalt not die. Though our commandment be general, come near. And so he held up his golden scepter and laid it upon her neck and embraced her and said, speak unto me. Then she said unto him, I saw thee, my Lord, as an angel of God, and my heart was troubled for fear of thy majesty. For wonderful art thou, Lord, and thy countenance is full of grace. And as she was speaking, she fell down for faintness. Then the king was troubled, and all his servants comforted her. And then it goes back to the regular biblical accounts. But you see how this kind of helps fill in the detail of how, you know, what actually happened or what didn't happen that bothers them. So, you know, Esther, she goes to the king to ask for her life all dressed up, but it wasn't her beauty. You know, it was God changing the king's heart. And how do we know that? Because at first he looks up and he's mad, and then she faints, and then he has compassion, and then God changes his heart. You know, then it's okay. And of course, the whole fact that Esther's this strong leading woman, here we have her quite the opposite of the Victorian ideal of, oh, please help me, I'm going to faint. And, you know, the gallant man coming to the rescue. It's all very funny. But it is interpretation, and it does highlight, if you read the editions, it highlights what's lacking in our biblical account, and it makes you ask more questions. Of course, I like the actual book of Esther, because I like it kind of left vague. I think it suits the style. Anyway, so I hope you've been encouraged to keep reading the story afresh. Read the editions for the fun of it. It'll help you cast a new light onto the original book. And have a good Purim and Shabbat Shalom. There's a worship service down below starting just about now.
Thank you.